It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. New research from the U.S. Census Bureau and AmeriCorps finds that volunteering at nonprofits has largely rebounded since the COVID-19 pandemic.
The survey shows that more than 75 million Americans over the age of 16 formally volunteered with a nonprofit between September of 2022 and September of 2023.
But Wisconsin is among 36 states where formal volunteering rates still lag behind pre-pandemic levels.
Jeannie Duffy is here, and she joins us to talk about the survey results and the level of volunteerism in Wisconsin. She's executive director of Serve Wisconsin. That's a state agency that manages federal funding for AmeriCorps projects in the state. Jeannie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into the survey findings and what they mean for Wisconsin, how does AmeriCorps work here in our state?
So AmeriCorps was founded in 1990, and when it was founded by the federal, it was decided that states understand the needs in their communities best. So federal funding gets passed down through the state, and then we at Serve Wisconsin accept grant applications twice a year from nonprofits and government agencies who are interested in running an AmeriCorps program. And we then grant out the funds to the organizations on the ground, who in turn engage almost 900 AmeriCorps members each year in the state of Wisconsin to solve community needs and help the people in their communities.
Can you give some examples of what these AmeriCorps projects are?
Yes. So I personally manage AmeriCorps programs. That is what you think of as young people working in schools, tutoring, helping bridge the literacy divide, helping kids get back up to speed after COVID, the educational lapses that happened then. We have hundreds of AmeriCorps members that work in our state and community parks doing conservation and resiliency works. We have an incredible program that helps homeless and runaway youth get into safe housing and get back on track in life. We stay safe, most importantly. We help kids who might be disconnected from school and work get their high school GED or equivalency degree and get some work experience, whether in the construction trades or in the conservation field, so they can have a productive life. So we take people at all stages of their life, from recent college grads trying to figure out what they want to do and get some work experience, people looking for a break, trying to figure out their next steps in lives, to helping out launching young people into a productive and civically engaged life.
Jeannie,
and I want to also
go ahead.
I know, I'm sorry. That's AmeriCorps. There's also the AmeriCorps Seniors, which is 10,000 people age 55 and older who every day are volunteering at nonprofits around the states. They are the backbones on the Meals and Wheels. They're taking their fellow seniors to doctor's appointments who can't drive. So there is a wide berth of AmeriCorps activity in the state of Wisconsin and across the nation.
You just gave examples of a really diverse range of initiatives, just a hive of activity, all needing some element of volunteerism. And so as you look at this Census Bureau and AmeriCorps report on volunteerism, what do you see here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think it's very positive. I mean, we are up over 6% from 2021, which means people are re-engaging after the pandemic. Wisconsin had always been a very high volunteer state. I mean, we are Midwestern nice. We help our neighbors. We like to volunteer. And it did take a toll during the pandemic. People couldn't get out in public. You know, traditional ways of volunteering were not available to people. But yet, at the same time, we weren't measuring how people were helping their neighbors, whether going to the store, shoveling the walk, doing things on behalf of people. And now our survey is much better at measuring not only formal volunteering, people who actually, you know, sign up to work at an organization or go to a hospital and volunteer, but also volunteering by, you know, helping your elderly parents, go to the store for them, shoveling for your neighbors, raking leaves. And also, for the first time ever, we are measuring virtual volunteering, which took off during the pandemic. We had many people who were doing virtual tutoring, and that is still going on.
Well, thank you so much for that distinction between formal and informal volunteering. Looking at some age groups here, the report finds that the largest gains in formal volunteering were from millennials, people without a high school degree, people who make less than $25,000 per year. What is helping to get these groups to volunteer?
You know, I think many people have, during the pandemic, felt disconnected. And volunteering is a great way to get reconnected in life. I mean, studies for years have shown that the happiest, longest living people are those who have good social connections with friends and their communities. And people are striving for social connection, I believe. And volunteering is a great way to make new friends. Also, if you're looking to do a career change, it's a great way to get work experience and make professional connections.
We're talking about,
I think also people see the need and they people are inherently good. And when they see the need, they're willing to step up and help out.
We're talking with Jeannie Duffy, Executive Director of Serve Wisconsin. That's a state agency that manages federal funding for AmeriCorps projects in Wisconsin. Talking about a recent survey from the U.S. Census Bureau and AmeriCorps that's tracking the level of nonprofit volunteerism nationwide. Jeannie, when you look at this survey, there are some states that are really excelling at volunteerism. Our neighbor Minnesota, for one, Vermont, Utah, at the very top in volunteer participation. Why might volunteerism vary widely from one state to another?
Well, I would say Utah is the Mormon Church is dominant in Utah, and they have a very strong service culture. So Utah always wins the volunteer awards for service. Minnesota, that kind of irks me too. And we should be at the same levels as Minnesota. There's no reason we shouldn't. And actually, Serve Wisconsin, a few years ago, received federal funds from the Volunteer Generation Fund, and now we are granting those out to organizations to help them improve and recruit their volunteer practices. Mm-hmm. So just a little plug for Serve Wisconsin, or if you're an organization that uses volunteers and could use some help in training, managing, or recruiting volunteers, you can apply to us for funding, and we will help you.
You mentioned earlier about digital volunteering in that realm. What type of projects are more suited to digital volunteering versus serving in person?
I think school tutoring, that has been wildly successful as digital volunteering. I mean, at first we had AmeriCorps members who tutored, and, you know, due to safety concerns, we never allowed people to do digital tutoring. But I think we developed some protocols and safety standards during COVID, and that has carried over. Also, a lot of senior companions can be visited virtually, especially during the pandemic. If people are still worried about respiratory illnesses or COVID, you know, visiting via Zoom is, why not as good as in person, can still be a way to have a visit with a senior who is a shut-in.
I wonder if volunteerism tracks at all with donations. Do they follow in similar patterns?
You know, that is a good question. I do not know the answer to that. You would kind of think so, because once people volunteer and their hearts and their to the cause, usually their money follows. That is a general fundraising trend. So, but that was not measured in the survey. But there was about, you can see about donating, and that was people who donate, well, to a political, oh, charitable giving. That is one of the marks of the survey. So you can see in Wisconsin that charitable giving is up, and it is higher than the national average. Up from 21, it's up 2.6%. So maybe there is a correlation between volunteering increasing and charitable giving increasing.
I want to circle back to AmeriCorps and your work. Hundreds of AmeriCorps members at service sites around Wisconsin Your funding, you had $8 million in 2021, then to $13 million this year for roughly the same number of volunteers and projects. Why is the need for funding scaling up in recent years?
I think that $8 million is low, but we do get, well, just increased costs. So our members, why they are volunteers, they receive a living allowance to serve. So why it's not much, if a member serves 1,700 hours for a full year, they receive $20,000. So it's roughly, you know, less than $12 an hour for service that they get to cover their living expenses. And the reason we do this is because we want everyone to have the opportunity to serve and not make service just a purview of, you know, upper class or upper middle class people. So if we do not provide a living allowance, we are excluding a large swath of people from service.
Do you run into challenges with expanding efforts to get volunteers across Wisconsin and securing further funding?
You know, we post-pandemic, we had a hard time recruiting volunteers and AmeriCorps members. But now our programs generally run on the academic year, so they start in September, and we have our programs have reported much higher enrollment rates and not as much recruitment challenges.
And this year marks the 30th anniversary of AmeriCorps in Wisconsin. You've been with the organization since 2016. As we wrap up here very shortly, what is one priority that you have for AmeriCorps going forward?
You know, that we continue to adapt and meet the community needs. Mm-hmm. So AmeriCorps is a federal program. So, you know, there's a lot of rules and regulations, and sometimes it's hard to pivot. But during the pandemic, we showed that we could really pivot and meet the current needs at the time, from whether helping out at vaccination stations or helping out at schools doing just packing lunches and digital stuff.
Continually reinventing yourself. Jeannie, thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Jeannie Duffy is Executive Director of Serve Wisconsin. It's a state agency that manages funding for AmeriCorps projects here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, ancient Native American mounds are rediscovered in Milwaukee's oldest operating cemetery. Find out about preservation efforts that are underway.
We're going to be talking to family members and talking to tribal leaders about how we can come to some agreement on the best way to interpret the site.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Native Americans have lived in the area now called Wisconsin for over 12,000 years. And throughout this time, Native people built sacred burial mounds.
According to the State Department of Natural Resources, Wisconsin has a large number of ancient burial and effigy mounds, but many have been destroyed or impacted by development.
We'll talk with an archaeologist in Dodge County who's leading efforts to clean up mound sites by carefully removing invasive vegetation.
But first, two mounds were recently rediscovered on the property of Milwaukee's oldest operating cemetery. The cemetery is currently working with tribal members on a plan to preserve and care for the mounds.
Sarah Tomlin is Executive Director of the Forest Home Historic Preservation Association for the Forest Home Cemetery and Arboretum in Milwaukee. Sarah, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
These two mounds at Forest Home Cemetery, they are ancient. They have a long history in Wisconsin, but they are recently coming before our attention. How did you become aware of the mounds?
Well, we are a historic site. And we do tours. We have about 17 docents that do historical tours. And one of our docents wanted to be accurate about where the mounds were that Increase Lapham had mapped out. So we got in touch with Bill Quackenbush, tribal leader from the Ho-Chunk. And he came out and we said, this is the original 72 acres that Increase Lapham designed.
And Increase Lapham is the civil engineer pioneer.
Yes. I mean, he's Wisconsin's first naturalist. He wrote several books by the time he was 25. He did so many amazing things. But he also, probably like less important for him in his life, he designed the first 72 acres of the cemetery. And he also was a city surveyor at the time. And so he mapped out a lot of the indigenous mounds that were in the area before they were developed. We knew that there were two conical mounds that had resided on the original 72 acres from maps that he had designed. And so we brought out Bill Quackenbush to take a look at it to see if he could interpret whether those mounds still existed, or at least give us an idea of kind of where they were. He came out in February of 2023, and he basically said, here's a mound and here's a mound. And it was very quick that he was able to interpret that. And I went into the office at the cemetery where we have our individual site maps. We have over 50 sections in the cemetery, and these were in section 15 and 19. And those maps, the burials are in a round form. So it's our theory that these were actually designed by Increase Lapham in order to preserve the mounds.
Wow.
Because that is not a very efficient way to bury people.
Right, right. So how are you then working with tribal community members to create a plan to care for these mounds into the future?
Well, so far we have let the Wisconsin Repatriation, Tribal Repatriation Committee know about it. We've talked to the Wisconsin Historical Society. We've been working with the Native American professor and American history professor, Dr. Brian Reinflesch, and also Dr. Jennifer Haas, who works at UWM in the anthropology department. We have not done anything yet. We have not made any decisions at this point. What we're doing now is we're going to be reaching out to all the stakeholders, and we have sort of the framework for a cultural resource plan so that we are able to do this in the correct way. And at this point, nothing's happened.
What do you mean by stakeholders? Who are the stakeholders?
Stakeholders would be people who are tribal nations. Also, we have burials in those mounds. So we have family members who are also part of those mounds. So being able to have all of the groups have some input into the interpretation of the site.
Can you talk about more what you learned about these mounds and their formation?
Well, they're conical mounds, and I think the earliest conical mounds date back as far as 500 BC. Mm. They are mortuary mounds. I mean, they were for the purpose of burial, is my understanding. And they were part of a larger group, like about 50 other mounds in the area. And this area, the settlers called the Indian Fields. And so it was an area that was occupied by people who were Native American.
So, you know, as you go forward here, how does this impact the cemetery's capacity for burials or your placement of future burials? I mean, this is, you know, two sections you're talking about, but you have dozens of sections.
Well, I mean, this is in the areas that are the mounds. Mm-hmm. They are some of our earliest burials. So the sections had their first burials in 1854. The cemetery dates back to 1850. And the most recent burial that's occurred in those spaces is in the 1960s. So it's been quite a while since we've had any burials in those areas. I mean, we are a National Historic Site. We are tasked with, you know, remembering people and also making sure that burial areas are protected. So I feel like this is completely in our wheelhouse, and it's a very good place to have these mounds. And so we're going to be, you know, talking to family members and talking to tribal leaders about how we can come to some agreement on the best way to interpret the site. Because I know this is something that's been very challenging for lots of other mounds in the state, and doing it right and making it, whether it's signage or not, how we interpret it. We definitely as a historic site and as a place that does tours, we do field trips too with children. So we look at this as an opportunity to have that educational component too.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
That is Sarah Tomlin, Executive Director of the Forest Home Historic Preservation Association for the Forest Home Cemetery and Arboretum in Milwaukee. Two mound discoveries there raising new questions about preservation efforts. And now we're joined by Kurt Sampson, Director and Curator for the Dodge County Historical Society Museum. He's also an interpretive volunteer at the Effigy Mounds National Monument and founder of the Effigy Mounds Initiative. Kurt, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
Good morning. You have a long history in carrying out preservation work for burial and effigy mounds around the state. What does that involve?
Well, basically, it involves identifying sites out there that are not protected by the Burial Sites Protection Act fully, which was enacted back in 1985-86 by Governor Thompson. And what I do basically with our group is we go around the state and we work with private and public landowners that have mound sites on their property. We approach those landowners and we offer to help get those mounds properly cataloged with the Office of the State Archaeologist, with the State Historical Society, with Amy Rosebrough, Dr. Rosebrough. That way they're cataloged burial sites and they are afforded the full protection of the Burial Sites Protection Act. And what a lot of landowners don't realize in the state is that if you have a mound site on your property and you have an archaeologist like myself come and get that site cataloged, that you can get a tax reduction on that portion of your property taxes. So there is incentive for landowners to help preserve the remaining mounds that are in the state. And then the other half of what we do is we go and we assess the site for best care practices to care for that mound site. Oftentimes these mound sites are overgrown with invasive woody plant species like buckthorn and honeysuckle and garlic mustard and things like that. And so I organize work crews to go out and help take care for the site, to take that those woody invasives off the site, and especially off the top of the mounds, which can be detrimental to the mounds, and any large trees that might be on top of mounds. Eventually those trees get old and they will fall over and uproot the mounds, so we take the trees off the mounds as well.
Kurt, when mounds are located in, say, a cemetery or in a forest parkland situation, is that more helpful to be able to institute best care practices to preserve those mounds well into the future?
Well, sure. There are several cemeteries around the state of Wisconsin that actually contain ancient burial mounds. And by and large, most of these cemeteries around the state have recognized those mounds as such and are caring for them by keeping trees off of them, keeping the vegetation down on the top of them. And we actually have one in Dodge County that's just a couple miles down the road where we have two large panther effigy mounds in a cemetery. It's called the Highland Prairie Cemetery. And the county does a good job of taking care of those mounds. So in a lot of cases, the Effigy Mounds Initiative hasn't really done a lot of work with cemeteries just because those sites are pretty well maintained. Most of the time, though, there's not interpretive signage on those sites that are indicating that these are mounds.
You recently received an award from the Wisconsin Historical Society for your work at Nitschke Mounds in Dodge County with the 46 documented effigy mounds there. Can you tell us about that project and your work there in preservation of this mounds group?
Sure. When I came to Dodge County as the director after finishing grad school at UW-Milwaukee, I was acutely aware that there were Dodge County had a very high concentration of mound sites that still existed, and I was very interested in documenting all of those mound sites, and Nitschke Mounds was one of them. It was right around the time that I came here, about 15, 16 years ago, that the Nitschke family had deeded the property over to the Dodge County Parks Department to turn it into a county park. And the Dodge County Parks Department didn't have any real firsthand experience caring for a mound site. And it was right around that time that I had formed the Effigy Mounds Initiative and decided to pick up the torch. So I contacted Bill Allenbeck, who's the director of the County Parks Department, and we worked out a management plan to care for the mounds in the park. And for really the last 6 winters, my volunteer crew and I have gone out there to basically work on the 14 mounds that are in the northern third section of the park that had not been cared for yet. And we basically worked from west to east to over 5 winters to clean out that site of all the invasives, all the trees off the mounds, provide a 5-foot buffer to each mound, and identify any native species of plants and trees that were kept. And one thing that we've learned over the last decade or so is that it's a better practice to keep the mature tree canopy on the site that's indigenous to the site, because that helps to keep the invasive species from overrunning a site. And there were part of sites at Lizard Mound State Park and at Nitschke that had been completely clear cut with the hope that they would turn that back into Oak Savanna Prairie. Well, the problem with that is that if you don't have the resources to continuously work towards that goal, within a season, those sites can be completely overrun again, and then you're back to square one. So you have to have the resources to do it. And the way the Burial Sites Protection Act is written in Wisconsin is that you can't have any subsurface disturbance of the mound site proper. So what we do is we cut those stumps flush to the ground or flush to the mound surface, and then treat them, and then continue to monitor that on a seasonal basis.
Wow, that is a lot of work, and it's a lot of documentation as well. Why are invasive species, invasive plants, so bad for these ancient mounds?
Well, it's just one of those things where, you know, if you leave a forested area that has invasive species like buckthorn, I mean, they just completely take over the entire forested area. And their root system is so invasive that it's very difficult to eradicate some of these invasive woody species. And they do impact the integrity of the mounds if they're on top of the mounds with their root systems. And so, yeah, it's best to cut those things back into to keep the larger trees off the mounds, because, you know, like I said, eventually those trees mature and they die and then they fall. And I've been on many, many mound sites around the state where this is happening, where actual ancient burials have been exposed from trees tipping over. And another site we're working on is up in Chetek, Wisconsin, where they have a site that's called the Pleasant Plain Mound Group. That's a very ancient conical burial mound site that is very overgrown. And last Saturday, we had our first care day up there, where we had 15 volunteers from the Effigy Mounds Initiative show up to start to work on that site as well. And that site had a lot of mounds that were also pitted into by relic hunters in the distant past. So those mounds were compromised from an erosional standpoint. And so we're working to eventually try to shore up those issues as well.
We talked recently with Ho-Chunk Elder Richie Brown about his work surveying and marking mounds around the state. And let's listen to what he said about the importance of these mounds.
These sites have a lot of power, have a lot of energy. And that's why you have to be real careful and respectful what you do there, too. But it's some amazing stuff, and that's what we're trying to do, to leave something for the younger generation.
Kurt, how do you go about doing this work respectfully as a non-tribal member?
Well, that's a good question. And what I've always done is reached out to the tribes, especially the Ho-Chunk, and I know Bill Quackenbush, the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer of the Ho-Chunk, very well, and several other Ho-Chunk members that I've consulted with over the years to you know, get their input about what they thought was appropriate and what wasn't appropriate to do on these mound sites. And I'll be honest with you, there have been some instances where I've been approached by Native American people that didn't think it was appropriate that people like me that are not Native American work on these mound sites. But from my experience with dealing with mounds for the better part of the last 30 plus years, it's been my experience that the more people are educated about the mounds, the better that they're protected. It's also my belief that these mounds are all part of our unique cultural heritage as a people in Wisconsin. And I firmly believe that it's all of our responsibilities to take care of these mounds. About 80 to 85% of the mounds that once existed have been destroyed. And there's only about 3,300 to 3,400 effigy mounds left. Mm. And that's not really a large number, even though it seems like a large number. And many of these sites are still threatened. And as you know, archaeological resources are a non-renewable resource. And once they're destroyed, they're gone forever. So I think it's part of our collective cultural heritage that all of us care for these sites at this point.
Kurt, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here anytime, and thank you for having me.
That was Kurt Sampson, director and curator of the Dodge County Historical Society Museum, founder of the Effigy Mounds Initiative. We talked with him about efforts to preserve and care for indigenous burial mounds. Earlier, we heard from Sarah Tomlin, who leads the Historic Preservation Association for the Forest Home Cemetery and Arboretum in Milwaukee, and their plans to care for two mounds that were recently rediscovered in the cemetery.
Coming up, meet the author of a new graphic novel about a Muslim girls basketball team in Wisconsin that got media attention in a breakthrough year.
It means so much to be represented and to be included in the literature and to be the hero of a book and have your friends who maybe are outside of your culture and background see you that way.
That's up next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Tonight on Milwaukee's South Side, a team of rising stars in high school basketball will play their first home game of the season.
The Salaam Stars girls basketball roster is an all-Muslim group of athletes. They are one of the first teams of its kind in the country.
They are two-time conference champions and hope to take home a third win this season.
Producer Mackenzie Crummy recently attended the team's game against the school's own alumni, which came down to the wire. Let's take a listen.
I'm playing from Wisdom School, and it's all girls team, and we've gone pretty far. We've won games. We've won conference championships. It kind of shows we're at the same level as other people.
That's Amina Farouk. She's a high school senior at the Salaam School District in Milwaukee. The girls' basketball team is one of the first, quote, all-Muslim, hijab-wearing basketball teams in the country. And tonight, I'm watching a match between the current players and the alumni. One player told me people assume she isn't aggressive on the court because she's Muslim. And I did not get that impression.
We're faster than them right now. They look like old grannies running up and down the court. There's very few people who can actually handle the ball as in dribble and comfortable to be with it.
The basketball team is part of the Salaam School District, a private prep school on Milwaukee's south side. It is one of the largest Muslim schools in the U.S. with enrollment of more than 1,000 students from kindergarten to 12th grade. The team became well known around the nation starting in 2019, after they went from a team that casually practiced and occasionally won to a highly competitive two-time conference champs.
Let's go, guys. Ready?
One, two, three, four!
Let's go!
Recently, award-winning author Henna Khan wrote a graphic novel about the students. Her novels center Pakistani-American and Muslim characters. It's called We Are Big Time. The entire team and supporters from the school attended a launch in Milwaukee. I asked what they thought of it.
I really liked the way there was representation. You don't see that a lot, especially with books. And I'm a big reader myself, so seeing that, because I live some of the things that were going on in the book, and it was like, just like, wow, you know, like a wow moment that other people maybe like can see this book or like pick it up, read it, and it just they know more about us and like what we do here.
Their coach, Cassidy Masak, was there. She is a former basketball player and started coaching in 2016 and took the team to another level. Coach Cass, as she is known, doesn't identify as Muslim, but says she has learned a lot from being at the school. She can sometimes recite the Arabic prayers, heard through the loudspeakers, even if she can't understand them.
I was listening to prayer the other day, like the call for prayer, and I was like, I don't know Arabic at all, but like I know what they're like, I can remember how it sounds. Like I don't know what they're saying, but I know like what comes next. But I'm like, I have no idea how to even write that down, you know, like, but I know what the sound is coming next. So.
But right now their minds are focused on the game. The alumni who are wearing black score first, but then the Salaam Stars wearing pink are starting to get hot. This game is intense. The Salaam Stars have never won in the alumni game before.
Will you tell me what's happening right now?
It's a very close game. It's 36-30. Stars are winning. We're winning. Safa made a very, very good layup. She made a nice little euro.
Okay, nice. And this, if you guys win, this will be your first win for the...
Yes, it will be our first win, which is so exciting. We've been wanting to win, especially because it's our seniors last year. We have some very important seniors on the team.
But the team sends in the freshmen.
So that should be interesting. But it's exciting, I think.
You got it!
Good job.
Oh, we've only got 30 seconds left.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they can't sell a lead. No, they can't. They got it. They can maintain possession. I believe in them.
It's a very close game. The last few seconds are coming down to a single shot.
Oh, boy.
To watch the players in action, their first home game is November 26th. Center Asil Ishtawi says anyone who likes basketball can enjoy the Stars.
On the court, it's just strictly basketball. So, like, I just feel like I'm seen for, like, a player rather than, like, you know, Muslim and all that. And I like that better, like, when it's on the court and it's just out there.
Special thanks to Mackenzie Crummy for producing that feature and Tyler Ditter for technical direction. Our next guest told the story of the team in graphic novel form, as we just heard. Henna Khan is an award-winning children's book author who writes about Pakistani-American and Muslim characters. Her recent graphic novel is We Are Big Time, features a fictional version of the Salaam Stars. Henna, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Henna, you feature the Salaam Stars in your novel, a graphic novel. What got your interest in the team?
It was actually a local educator, Aliza Werner, who shared a story about the girls with me and the team and their amazing season. And she said, I think you might be interested in this because I had written about basketball in the past and I was writing books for children. And she was right because the story was so compelling and the visuals were so stimulating, and I knew it was a story that I just really wanted to tell somehow.
One thing that struck me in your book, and this is true of the real life models for your book, you know, they're high school kids, right? They're dealing with their classes and their grades and a tough athletic schedule and friendships and family and all that stuff. And now all of a sudden, these basketball players are expected to be, what, the face of women Muslim athletes in the United States. How did they handle, you know, on top of all the plenty of high school pressure they had, how did they handle that?
I think they did an incredible job. You know, I was so struck by their poise and their eloquence and the way they were able to really express themselves and what they felt in the moment. But it was a lot of pressure. And that was one of the things I wanted to talk with them about, you know, privately, was, you know, what was that like getting all that unexpected media attention and having cameras follow you around? And what did you feel about the questions you got? And that became part of the story I wanted to tell, that, you know, that balancing of everything you described, plus this expectation of being representatives, because that's a lot to shoulder as a high school student.
Something that comes up a few times is What I think of is like a Bend It Like Beckham narrative. Now, this is a story. Bend It Like Beckham was a Sikh family in England with a, you know, conservative parents who don't want their daughter playing sports. So it seems like in these interviews with these Muslim girls here in Wisconsin, there's this expectation that they were fighting their family, their parents, to be able to play sports in public. Not so much, it looked like.
Yeah. And that was something that was really striking to me, that if it was another girl's, you know, basketball team, I don't think they would be asked those questions. But because of their backgrounds, they were asked things like, you know, what do your parents feel about you playing sports? And did you have to fight for that? Or, you know, being asked questions about their thoughts on foreign policy or immigration, you know, so far outside of the scope of high school athletics. And that was something I wanted to put in the book, too, which is, you know, a gentle way of introducing this idea of the different treatment that they were getting, even though some of the media hinted at, you know, very overt discrimination or prejudice that they were facing. And that was another thing that I pressed them on, to find out, you know, what was actually happening. And apart from comments and, you know, funny looks sometimes, and, you know, there really wasn't any overt outright discrimination during their regular season.
And the star of your book, at least the fictional version, her family is not an obstacle. They're incredibly supportive. Is that what you found for most of the team, that their families were almost cheerleaders for them?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I even watched a video where one of the players, you know, families, the crew goes into their home and you get to meet the family, and she's playing basketball with her brother. And I love that so much. That was something I wanted to include in the story. You know, their parents did become cheerleaders and actually were at the games, and beyond the parents, that the whole community and the whole school turned up for these games. So it became a real, you know, connector of everybody. And that was what I wanted to highlight, you know, counter to what people might expect. They were very supported by their families.
Now, you've done this as a graphic novel. I thought it was a great read. I'm a little above the target demographic age, I think. Who is your main audience here, Hannah?
Really, you know, graphic novels are so widely read, so it can be anybody who enjoys a good story and a good comic. You know, we made this technically, I really don't enjoy it when publishers put age brackets on books, because I don't think it's
valid. No one
else
can read this if you're over 14.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's really to like tell the booksellers where to shelve it, and librarians, of course. So even though this is written for what we call middle grade, which is upper elementary, middle school, you know, features a high school team. So we're hoping that it will be read really widely.
Hannah Kahn is with us talking about her new graphic novel. It's called We Are Big Time. It's based on a Milwaukee girls basketball team. Hannah, this is taking place in Milwaukee. A couple things I loved in it. One, okay, you've got a family of Muslims. They're into basketball. A local big name, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, is referenced a few times. Is this a role model for the real-life Salaam stars at all?
I think it might be, you know, past their time.
Maybe their parents, right.
Exactly. And that was based on my husband actually grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And so, and I remember, you know, being a kid and what Kareem Abdul-Jabbar meant to the Muslim community at that time. And so that was a lot based on his experience, and his confusion around the Mecca Center made its way into the book, where he as a young child thought that that was where Muslims prayed toward downtown Milwaukee. So I thought that was so funny, I had to put it in the book.
That was a laugh out loud moment for me. Yes, praying toward Mecca, the athletic center in Milwaukee.
Very local, right?
Definitely. Now, this is not your first book. You've written a bunch of books, mostly with Pakistani American and Muslim characters. For the non-Pakistani Americans, the non-Muslim readers, what kind of things are you hoping people understand that and take away from your characters?
Yeah, I mean, most of all, I just want them to feel like they find a friend in each of my characters, and that they can really connect and relate to them, even though their, you know, background or culture or religion might be different than them. And that's the way I felt about all the great books I read growing up. And beyond that, you know, just really maybe getting a glimpse into Pakistani American Muslim family like mine, and hopefully seeing how much we all have in common with each other, a lot more than, you know, we might think.
And then flipping it around for, say, a young Muslim in Milwaukee, maybe reading your book and maybe seeing a little bit of their home life, their food choices, whatever represented there. What do you hope that means to them?
I talk to kids all the time around the country, and I get told by them, you know, how much it means to them, how proud it makes them feel. I hear from teachers and librarians about kids who never spoke up before, suddenly wanting to share these parts of their lives. So it means so much to be represented and to be included in the literature and to be the hero of a book and have your friends who maybe are outside of your culture and background see you that way. And that's always been a goal of mine, to make the little kids out there who are like me, you know, feel really proud of who they are.
On one hand, people could see this as a particular story about, you know, Muslim girls playing basketball. There's a more universal story at the core of it, I felt like, where you have this group of kids. Their team is not done well, to put it mildly. They don't play together as a team, and they find common bonds and pull together and find success. Can you talk about that, the universal side of that?
Absolutely. That's what really struck me when I started reading about the stories, and I could see the appeal of, you know, their turnaround season, and it just read like one of those great sports stories. And I love that. I love that, you know, I try to reach for universality in all of my books, but especially when it comes to sports, it is the equalizer, right? And it does provide this instant sense of belonging and community and shared goals and purpose for everybody on that team, you know, team values. But it can also be especially important to somebody in a new environment, like my character, Leah, and anyone struggling to fit in, to get this instant family. And then, of course, in the case of these girls, we see the wider effect that having a team to root for can have on a larger community, and the joy that that can bring, and the heartache sometimes, but mostly the joy.
And the slogan the team unites around, I love as a parent of women athletes myself, more than the score. The idea that, okay, they win or they lose, they're playing for a lot more than that. Did that phrase come from you? Did that notion come from you? Or was that from the original team?
That was from the original team and from Coach Cass herself. And she mentioned, you know, telling the girls that and that becoming the slogan of the team. And I loved that. And I asked for her permission to put it in the book because I thought it just encapsulated so much what these girls are about, and also what they were asked to do, and to be more than the score, and to be more than a basketball team. So I love that slogan, and they still use it, I believe.
All right, I want to talk about the most important target audience now. You mentioned you had a book release party with the members of the team. What's been their response to your portrayal of a fictionalized version of their real life experience?
I mean, for a lot of these girls, you know, the season was from 2018 to 2019, and some of them were seniors or, you know, upperclassmen. And then soon after, their next season was when the pandemic hit and schools closed. So everything was disrupted. So they mentioned to me that it was really nice to be able to go back and relive their experience and to celebrate it again. And I think for them, just having this really significant moment in their life be encapsulated this way and preserved this way really, really meant a lot to them. So they had wonderful feedback for me, and it just made me so happy and elevated the book for me too, to know that it's so personal for so many of these girls and for their wonderful coach.
Hannah, thanks so much for sharing your work with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. It means a lot.
Hannah Khan is an award-winning children's book author. A recently released graphic novel, We Are Big Time, is based on a Milwaukee girls basketball team.
The Packers play on Thanksgiving this year, and tomorrow we're going to hear from a Packers superfan who is in the team's Fan Hall of Fame.
We'll hear about his career as a lifelong fan and his shrine to the team, and we want to hear from you. Do you consider yourself a super fan of any team in the sports world, Packers or otherwise?
Let's hear about it. What got you into the team, and what does being a super fan look like to you in your life?
Are there rituals, get-togethers? Do you feel like you're part of a fan community? Share your story. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text at 888-642-0232. Again, that's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. We hope you're a super fan of that team, too. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.